We want to have legitimacy. We want to have the public have trust in us. We want the public to see that we are doing things correctly. We are morally right. We are ethically right. We are legally right. All right. We're being fair across the board to everybody. We're treating everybody with respect.
Hey, guys, check out the 2023 Street Cop Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, Gaylord Convention Center. It's going to be the event of the year. Keynote speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Medal of Honor recipient, Navy SEAL Jason Redmond, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Marine Corps Special Forces and Leadership Coach Cody Alford, Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff David Clark, and Sheriff Mark Lamb. It's going to be one hell of an event. And on top of that, we have all of our instructors and additional instructors from other companies going to be at the event, giving you everything they know for you to have a successful career and get the results you want to get in the field as a police officer. On top of attending the event, you'll get face-to-face time with every instructor attending the event, and all the keynote speakers will spend time with you. We got special events all week, giveaways, nightlife. It's going to be really, really worth your time, energy, and effort. I promise you, you will not regret it for a second. To register for the conference, check out streetcop.com, click conference, and everything you need will be there on the homepage. If you are looking for a room, just click book a room. The block has been sold out at the Gaylord Opryland Convention Center, but there are many hotels nearby within a walking distance of the event. You don't want to miss out on this opportunity. We will see you there.
You trying to be a street cop?
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and we have with us Jeff Schultz, one of our instructors. He is a, I don't want to give the wrong information, New York State Police, hostage negotiator, crisis intervention, all that great shit. I don't want to mistake how many years you did it. I know it was like 16 or 17 or 18 years. So you just tell everybody what your qualifications are and the class that you teach now at the company.
Yeah, thanks, Dennis. So I do hit a lot of stuff with the state police. Dennis, you hit it about right. About 16 years as a crisis negotiator for the New York State Police. I retired back in May. When I retired, I was the senior investigator running all of the training for the Bureau of Criminal Investigation in the New York State Police, about 1,200 investigators and senior investigators. And when I retired, I was also the coordinator of the State Police Crisis Negotiation Program. So I took the FBI course back in 2006, and I got into it, you know, because I really like talking to people and really like making that connection with people. And I had a bunch of successful jobs with it and really liked it. And now in retirement, I've been lucky enough to get hooked up with your company, and I'm teaching de-escalation and crisis intervention that actually works for street cop training. And we got a busy summer coming up. Six or seven classes right now, I think, booked through May through August. So I'm really excited about it.
You know, it's interesting when you hear a topic like de-escalation, I think that there is an association of wokeness with it. And there's nothing 95% of this world wants to avoid more than having to endure wokeness. And maybe you can give some insight into people's concern. And again, this is not a sale for your class, but I guess the concern of the mixture of the two, of why they're kind of synonymous with each other versus the actual class and the program, the principles we're teaching that actually work.
Yeah, you know, Dennis, that's a very good point about the wokeness and the trepidation that people have when they hear de-escalation, right? They think it's woke policing. They think it's soft policing. It's not. It's smart policing. It's safe policing. And it's nothing new, man. It's stuff we've been doing our whole career. It's stuff we've been doing our whole lives. And one of the things I bring to it, and I try to tell cops, road cops, street cops, is that I want to give you a new perspective on this, right? Because, you know, it's something that we've done our whole careers. It's something we've done our whole adult lives. We've all dealt with conflict, right? We've all had incidents with family, with friends, with jobs. You know, now you become a cop, you deal with the public, right? Even out in the public sector, right? People who are doing job interviews, people who are, you know, customer service facing organizations have the need for de-escalation because it's conflict with people. And like you said, we want to avoid that use of force if we can, but the use of force hasn't gone away. All right. One of the things I talk about in my classes very early on is we look at some case law that talks about the objective reasonableness of the force that an officer uses. And the fact that there's no case law out there that says you have to try de-escalation before you go to force, before you go to a use of force, because sometimes we don't have time to, right? So It's not the touchy-feely. It's not the wokeness. It's not, you know, soft policing. It's smart policing. And I try to get it across to officers. I try to get it across to administrations that this is not only what's expected of you now, really, it's been expected of you since policing began, but it's not a bad thing. It's going to save your agency liability. It's going to save you liability. It's going to enhance the legitimacy of your agency. You know, it's smart policing. It's communicating with people, and it's making a connection with people. And if we're faced with an immediate threat, Dennis, we're going to go to that use of force, you know, be it hands-on, be it less lethal, be it physical force, be it deadly physical force, whatever that situation calls for. If we're faced with that immediate threat, then verbal de-escalation is out the window, right? We're going to go to do what we have to do to go home. And there's nothing's changed with that. You know, we go home and we need to be safe, and it's nothing that's changed. You know, we're going to try to talk to people when we can, but if we can't talk to people, hey, if we got to go hands-on, we got to go hands-on. And that's part of de-escalation itself. And I like to think of de-escalation, Dennis, as an outcome. You know, it's not a tactic in of itself, because think about it. We use so many things to de-escalate. We use verbal communication. We use nonverbal communication. We just, our presence sometimes can de-escalate things. Of course, it can also escalate things, right? But we want to go ahead and we want to try to talk to people, and we want to make that connection. And it's been proven to work since the 70s with policing, when the NYPD started the first hostage negotiation unit, when they started to slow things down, look at the dynamic inactivity of things and trying to understand motives of perpetrators when it was safe to do so. And that's what we're talking about, Dennis. We're talking about when it's safe to do so. We're not going to go ahead and try to talk our way out of somebody who's coming at us with a knife or pointing a gun at us or any number of other things that would allow us to use objectively reasonable force. As long as we can articulate what we're doing, we're going to be good. And that's one of the things that I try to get out there right away in my class and let officers know, like, okay, we're not in a woke class here. We're checking the box. No, I want to give people a new perspective on this using skills that they already have to reduce uses of force, reduce liability, and keep people safer.
You know, here you keep saying that somebody coming at us with a knife recently. I don't know if you were privy to seeing something that happened in Paterson, New Jersey here, which I've been interviewed on our news networks here. I just did a ABC morning show today explaining what this was about and what happened. And, you know, fortunately enough, the people that interviewed me, as briefly as it was, were at least critical thinkers in the sense of common sense, where they said, you know, what's your thoughts? Do you think that this was a situation where it created issues for the police officers? And I said, we had body worn camera videos and shows 5 hours of many different types of interventions that were applied, all from the crisis negotiator, the hostage negotiator, family members being brought in, begging this guy to stop, them using less than lethal, many different forms of it. And essentially what ended up being police officers who created a barrier between them and the suspect. And it looks like it's a couch or something like that. And then he comes out of the bathroom after telling them that he's going to take a cop with him, and with a butcher knife attacks the police, and they subsequently, their emergency response team and officers on scene had to fire rounds and take that man's life. So clear as day that hands off to the men and women at Paterson Police Department for doing everything they could within the means of reasonableness. I won't even say that they needed more. I don't know if there's anything you could have brought to that scene. I don't know if enough about the dynamics, the ins and outs, and all the details, but
sure.
From the outside, I can comfortably say it looks like they've exhausted everything they could. So it alludes to your point of, hey man, sometimes it's not a resolvable situation. That is right. What we're handed, and we don't have an option. We're not dying because now there's some community upheaval and they're a little upset because their friend decided to try to kill the police right after 5 hours of negotiations. So, you know, when you say, why is this stuff important? Clearly now we can go forward and show that, hey, we did everything we could. And that's right. An important thing. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can really articulate there based on, I'm not familiar with the incident either, but based on what you told me, I can't see how you wouldn't be able to articulate everything that you did, every action that that suspect took, and what ended up happening for them to use that deadly physical force. You know, all the steps that they went through, all the ways that they tried to go ahead and resolve that situation verbally. You know, and I said before, de-escalation is an outcome. And if you look at the outcome of that situation, as tragic as it may be, it was de-escalated, right? And people don't like to hear that either, especially administrations. But sometimes that's how we de-escalate things, because we're preventing it from hurting somebody else or hurting ourselves. So with the way you described that, you know, kudos to the men and women of that department and in acting the way that they did and taking all the steps that they could to try to prevent that. But de-escalation is, you know, how we achieve that outcome of de-escalation is very, very much dependent upon the individual that we're dealing with and the actions of that individual.
I was on News Channel 12 and I made a statement, and I did it today this morning on this radio show. I explained that there is not a police officer that I've ever met in my life, especially modern day 2023, that has the intention of showing up at work trying to take somebody's life. As a matter of fact, we do everything we can as a profession to avoid having to take somebody's life. And not only for the fact of us being human beings and not wanting to harm people, the people who are attracted to this job are probably some of the best cuts of society that we have to offer, but also on the administrative side of what you have to go through when you pull the trigger is a nightmare. Essentially, you're almost charged criminally and then you're cleared by a grand jury. It's pretty wild.
Absolutely.
I've been told that these shooting response teams from these attorney general's offices show up and say, like, you're being charged with murder. We're going to true bill it and see if it goes through and whether it's going to pass the grand jury muster. Nobody wants to go through that. That's a horrible thing. But we're willing to go through that because we've been chosen as human beings to show up and respond to these situations. So with that being said, have you ever known a police officer or yourself show up to work with the intention of killing somebody that day?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. Like you said, you know, the legal ramifications of it, the stigma of it, the stuff that you're going to put your family through, the stuff that you're going to go through mentally, physically, emotionally. Absolutely not. That's the last thing we want to do. We all know it can happen. Like you said, we signed up for that. I think, you know, 99.9% of us signed up for the right reasons, that we want to help people. We want to do good things. But no, I've never known anybody that wants to show up to work to take somebody's life. Absolutely not. No, that's the worst possible thing that could happen to the police officer, I think. A police officer, the police officer's agency, the police officer's family, the police officer's friends. You know, it just doesn't stop with that one officer. The effects of trauma that go out from that, you know, touch everybody that's involved with that police officer, your partners, you know, your agency. It's a horrible thing, even when it's completely justified, you know, and that's what most of them are, completely justified. You know, we have the ones that make the news every few years, right? And those are the anomalies. When you look at the number of police citizen interactions, right, in the millions upon millions upon millions, and you look at the use of force that's in those incidents, the low, low percentage of that, and then even lower than that is the percentage of officer involved shootings. And then much, much lower than that is the officer involved shootings that result in a fatality. It's just ridiculous that, you know, police are painted with that brush by certain parts of the public, certain parts of the media, certain parts of politicians that, you know, portray us as people who want to go out and just hurt and kill people. Absolutely ridiculous.
I had a class earlier this week in Kettering, Ohio, Dayton area. And well, I had a small discussion with the class because I go on my impromptu rants and raves. I think people kind of buy their tickets to see some of that shit when we're doing in class. And I talked about canine units and, you know, really, I think I'm a deep thinker and I try to really put a lot of analyzation behind theories and practices and whys and why nots. And I look at this canine unit, and after so many years of being in this profession and being associated with this profession, whatever you want to call it, I've spoke to a lot of canine handlers. And one thing I hear over and over again is, it's very interesting that you have administrations, politicians who essentially don't want canine units in their jurisdictions because they don't want them biting people. The crazy thing is, the truth of the matter is, when you speak to canine handlers who have dual-purpose dogs that do bite people, most of the time, 99% of the time, they don't have to bite people. The mere presence of the dog and the dog barking, the threat of the dog creates such an avoidance of actually having to, one, get physical with them, two, deploy the dog, or three, risk the lives of police officers. So while there's some stigma behind, we're going to get sued if the dog bites, I would actually think that I'm able to prove that when you employ a dog in most of those use of force situations, you're saving the actual money from the lawsuits when your police officers, who you failed to train on how to restrain, physically control, or fight subjects, have to pound their fucking face in because they don't know what else to do, because naturally, as human beings, we're going to go into what we think's going to work because we don't know what's going to work, especially when these men and women have begged you to go to Brazilian jiu-jitsu training to help offset some of the costs, to help implement a physical fitness program. It's just very interesting. I could imagine the conversations that were going on behind the scenes prior to last month at Memphis, Tennessee, when I bet you these 500-600 cops are like, we don't get any training. I fucking know. I don't even got to look at it. I know they didn't get any training. I know they were, and this is the repercussions of these politicians saying, we'll defund them, don't worry about it, or criticizing us publicly. Now you get what? You get low-level candidates who are showing up to take the job. They're now trying to toss more people's money at them. So instead of spending money on the people, the resources that you had and keeping them and investing into your people, taking that $20,000, $25,000 bonuses and saying, look, let's just take the people we have and make them really, really good. We have real good potential here. We know who they are already. We don't have to guess. Instead, now it's those people are gone. We've lost those resources. Let's take $25,000, $10,000, $15,000 signing bonuses and now toss them at people that we're hoping we might get a rare out of, that they're decent as cops. And, you know, I don't know what they're up against now, but you can thank your politicians who are anti-police politicians for the state of affairs that we're in now. You could have taken this money and essentially invested into your canine units. You could have funded canine units. You could have funded Brazilian jiu-jitsu training or training for police officers in the new age and era and style of having those skill sets. And you would have avoided, one, the public embarrassment, but the $11.8 million lawsuit you're going to pay out to that gentleman's family. So how would you like to spend the money? You want to spend it up front when you cry and bitch that there's no training money, you don't have money for a canine unit, nobody's savvy enough to figure it out, or we don't do that, we don't have time for that, we're short-staffed. These police agencies that are ignoring the clear indications of how to make things better by making better things and making better cops, they are suffering extreme detriment. But I guess back to my point is, what's your thoughts and feelings on the tool of a canine and its correlation to de-escalation?
It's key. I mean, like you said, the canine itself is an element of de-escalation. People see that dog, people hear that dog barking, they don't want to get bit. You know, if it's somebody who is, you know, we're not going to be able to de-escalate with, and probably a canine's not going to scare off somebody who is, you know, cracked out of their mind on drugs, who's completely enraged. They're probably going to fight anyway, right? But for most of our encounters, most of our police citizen encounters, yeah, that dog is going to be a huge de-escalation tool. Absolutely. Just having that dog's presence there. And getting to what you said about the administrations and looking at that money, they don't look at it. And that's the problem with the politicians and the administrations, because they don't want to spend it up front. They'd rather spend it later on. You know, they'd rather spend more later on, because that's not today. They're just looking at right now. They're looking at being able to tell the public, oh yeah, we're saving money today because we defunded the police and we cut this much money and we gave it to community housing or whatever. They think that's what the public wants to hear. And when that lawsuit comes down the road, do you ever see that getting really too much attention right away? No, it'll get out there eventually. But hey, you know what? We saved X amount of dollars on Monday. Let's not worry about what we're going to have to spend on Friday. You know, and that's the way it looks. But canines are huge, man. I was never a canine officer. A lot of friends who were. I've always seen them do great things, really, really great things. And, you know, you get people to come out of the woods real quick. You get people to come out of a basement real quick or under a house real quick. Good stuff. All part of de-escalation, all part of that outcome of de-escalation, definitely.
When I sat through your class for the first time, albeit I wasn't able to sit through all of it, the first opening session of your class is very interesting to me, because what you do is essentially what I do, but mine's more drawn out throughout the day. And we play this game of, do you think these police officers are trained or untrained? Watch these videos. What do you think? And Jeff shows a series of different videos, maybe six videos, something like that. And I don't know exactly. So he shows the outcomes of people who have not had any kind of formal training in communication. And there's these things called verbal judo. You know, I don't know much about that. I never took a verbal judo class. And I believe that's just a phrase or a label of a certain class. Basically, it's how to communicate. Right. So when I watch this, I think in the first 20 minutes of anybody taking this training, anybody who's looking at this, they're going to go, I am glad I'm here because I might have been the guys in videos 1, 3, and 5. I want to be the guys in 2, 4, and 6. So can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, the videos are great because, you know, we hate the Monday morning quarterback people, right? But how do we learn from our mistakes? We learn from, you know, we learn from other people's mistakes and our own mistakes. And we also learn from what people do well. And in the videos, I think there's a good mix of things that people do well and things that people could do a little bit better. So yeah, I ask people to put themselves in their shoes and think about situations they may have had that are similar, situations, you know, that they could be in tomorrow, that they've been in, and what the outcomes were. And then throughout the class, we actually go back to a lot of these videos and break it down a little bit more. And, you know, after we've talked about a certain topic, say in class, now maybe that has a little more relevance. And we say, here, look at this. And, you know, do you see why this was done at that point? So I think, yeah, the videos are a great tool to kind of get people, keep people's mind open up to, okay, you know, this isn't going to be death by PowerPoint. We're not just going to be sitting here today. We're actually going to learn something. We're going to talk about actual things that have happened. We're going to talk about case law. We're going to talk about real life experiences. And that's what it's about. And that's what training should be, right? And it should be an opportunity, not an obligation. And that's what I like to look at it as.
I think it really opens people's eyes up and enables them to understand what they've been doing wrong very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I think every police officer goes through is this, I don't know who I am yet, so I behave this way. Nobody's right. Taking their arm, putting it around them and saying, hey, did you know you get more bees with honey? I think everybody goes through that in the most sense, unless you really get a good field training officer, which we know about 15, 20% of them are actually decent. The rest are, because we know that in this profession, typically what happens, not in every place, they find the most talented officers and put them where? Into specialized units, right?
Yes.
They need those guys
wherever they're going to get the whatever the job wants.
So they'll take them and say, hey, you know, that guy in patrol, you know, squad 4, that dude's, he's on it, man. He's really out there. We should start looking at him. We need a new guy in narcotics soon. That guy seems to get a lot of stuff. He knows the fucking streets. We should get him in here. And before you know it, squad 4 is depleted of that guy. So squad 4 now has lost maybe somebody who's a good communicator or somebody who's good at getting drugs. So now for squad 4's hours, nobody else is getting drugs. Nobody's communicating. But I think a lot of us go through this period, this indoctrination of when we learn how to talk to people, how much easier it makes our life and how, and I say that very macro and I'll go into detail on why that makes your life easier. What's your thoughts on that? What's your thoughts on when we learn and how fast this class can get you to learn how to communicate with people?
I think this class will really speed it up because what we're talking about is we're talking about things, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, that we already have as police officers, as members of society. We have these communication skills. We just have to expand on it. We have to recognize what we're doing and how we're doing it. Because it's not as simple as just talking to somebody. You have to talk to somebody, you have to communicate with somebody, but you have to make that connection with them too, right, Dennis? You have to, you know, you have to get this person to think of you as their ally. Because if somebody doesn't think that you're sincere, are they going to talk to you? You know, think about how we make friends. Think about how we conduct our relationships. Do we talk to somebody? And if we think that person's an asshole, do we want to be friends with them? Do we want to have a relationship with them? No, we don't. Right. So we need to make that connection with people. And I'm not saying we have to be friends with these people that we're dealing with. We're certainly not going to be friends with them. But if we show them empathy, if we show them projected or what I like to call now professional sincerity, right, they're going to feel like we're an ally. They're going to feel like, hey, you know what? I trust this guy, this girl. Maybe I can talk to them a little bit. And we invite that conversation with that person to go ahead and make a connection. Look for these hooks that we can go back to. So yeah, this class kind of brings all that together, lets people know where they can find it inside themselves, gives them examples of how to do it. You know, and we do some interaction. We break the class into groups. We have them talk to each other about certain possible crises that somebody could be going through. We put a couple people on spot here and there in the group to do different activities. So it's a good interactive day and it really brings out like hey, you know what? I know I never realized I was doing this before, but now that I know how to do it, I can do it even better. And I can try to make those connections with people.
I don't know if we have a class that makes a more professional police officer. And I'm not saying skilled, although obviously that's a big part of taking this program, knows how to see crime. I think what this does is it is a really one of those key foundational pieces that all police officers need to have. I think everybody should go through this training. Even if you're trying to be the narcotics guy, the canine guy, the SWAT guy, because at some point, all of us are going to have to learn how to communicate. And that's one of the biggest downfalls of law enforcement. We can watch a lot of these videos. We can critique them and say, such a failure of communication here. This could be just resolved so much more differently. Right. And it's not even their fault because they weren't trained, because they went to an academy where they swung a stick at a bag and screamed, get back. They learned how to march. They know what pushups are. It's just, it's flabbergasting to me where these people who are in charge of these institutions where we're saying, this is where cops come to learn. We are the people at this agency where cops come to depend on getting new skills from. You all have to start understanding that you're not going to have the resolution for everything. It's impossible. You're going to have to relinquish a lot of this stuff off to companies like this, where somebody is able to go out and spend time collecting those who are the best at this. You can't. I have such a problem with train the trainer. That drives me fucking insane.
Right.
The reason is, even to try to become an instructor at this company, you can't just say, like, I went to train the trainer. I've been doing it for 3 months. One of the criterias to be an instructor at Street Cop Training, and albeit if we miss, that's why we run a free class to begin with. We take responsibility and say, that's why it's a free class. We were seeing if this woman or man was the person who was the guy we or girl we thought they were going to be. But we have such a strict process here, because you can almost guarantee when you show up to a class of ours, you're talking to somebody who we've spent time finding and vetting to ensure that when you come up for de-escalation training, it is not just some slideshow and bullet points and some hypothesis by some council social worker who just got done smoking weed in the back alley and was meditating this morning with incest and has no idea how law enforcement works. Right. So when I look at this program, I say, I don't know if you can get a more professional officer or somebody gets professionalism or understands it immediately, at least in the eyes of the beholder, than this training program. And I'll tell you why. When you watch police videos, you can see somebody who knows how to communicate and who doesn't. I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to do that. When I see that, and when we learn how to communicate with people, I see less internal affairs investigations and complaints, less use of forces, less lawsuits, and less black eyes. So how do you tell an agency this is what you need? How do we put a program out and we don't have the 37,000 cops in the state of New Jersey showing up to this program? And that's corrections, EMS, everybody across the board.
Sure.
Where is their focus going to when we talk about things like this?
The agency's focus you're talking about, where's their focus?
I think everybody's focus. Why are people not considered? If they're crying publicly that we need de-escalation training, and we show up and say, we have the best one there is, we can prove it, send your people. And they're still like, well, hold on. We know that there's a lot of reasons why, but what do you say to them when we talk about, or how do you respond when I talk about the four things that I talked about? Less IAs, less use of force, less lawsuits, less public black eyes, more trust with the police. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, the trust with the police, I think, is a huge selling point, because when we de-escalate in the community, we're enhancing the legitimacy of our agency, right? You know, we've all heard of legitimacy in policing, right? And when I first heard about it, and I did some training on that, and I read into it, took a class, I bought into it, because that's not woke either. We want to have legitimacy. We want to have the public have trust in us. We want the public to see that we are doing things correctly. We are morally right. We are ethically right. We are legally right. All right. We're being fair across the board to everybody. We're treating everybody with respect. You know, I say one thing in my class here, I'll give a little bit away in my class, that when I was a new trooper, right, I went to a complaint and I was like, why am I here today? This is bullshit. But to that person who called me, it was like the biggest thing ever, right? So it all comes down to our service. And somebody told me that the good people of the state will call the police but once in their life, right? I said, okay, so we should give everybody that service. When we give everybody that good service, right, we give everybody this service, we show them that we're doing the right thing, That enhances the legitimacy of our department. It makes us look better in the public's eye. And if we can influence an individual, we can influence a group. That individual will go back to the group and talk about a positive experience with the police. We influence a group. That group can go talk to somebody, an individual in their group, and talk about a positive experience with the police. So, yeah, I don't know what the holdup from administrations and guys and girls in the field is to go to stuff like this, but I think you hit it the nail on the head before, that trepidation about it being just another woke, check the box. We're going to sit through a PowerPoint because somebody sued the department, or, you know, the mayor's cousin's sister twice removed, whatever, had a bad experience with the police, and they said we need more training. So again, it's got to be looked at as an opportunity, not an obligation. And you get into it what you get out of it what you put into it, right? So that's the other thing too, is convincing people, hey, what do we do all day? We communicate, right? We talk to people all day. That is our biggest weapon, is talking to people. And yeah, when it doesn't work, we're going to use other avenues of de-escalation. We're going to use that force that's objectively reasonable, that, you know, in the class, we'll talk about what the courts look for to articulate, for you to articulate that it's objectively reasonable. But yeah, I just wish people would, you know, departments would put more funding towards training, send people to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, send people to de-escalation classes, send people to hostage negotiation classes, send people to interview classes, everything about communication and keeping yourself safe. We need to do more and more of that. And like you said, hitting a bag saying get back doesn't do that.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well.
I can't think of a profession, or maybe I would actually group this profession in some of the top professions where you constantly have to be educating, and it shouldn't be forced. It should be elected. People should want to go to it. And you know, the crazy thing is, Jeff, you and I both know, as we're doing this for so many years, that there are so many cops that desperately beg to go to training. The public doesn't know that. They beg their administration to go to training, and they're constantly denied. Yep. They don't get offered anything. They're told, go figure this out. Imagine telling a brain surgeon who said, listen, I need to know how to work on these brains, where there's lives on the line. You guys have to, the hospital here has got to send me to more training out of these classes, and we'll have a better outcome. We'll save more patients. And then you guys in turn will show. That's okay. That's the hospital will go, you're right. You do need more. We'll invest in you. But the police officer who has the same culpability, the same fragile lives in their hands on what to do in a situation, gets nothing. It is insanity. Now, some of these people in these political positions, some of these administrators, AKA managers, not leaders, because leaders know what to do, how to do it, and how to solve problems, and they can get people to enroll in their vision and their belief. They don't have to tell people what to do. They go, follow me. We're going this way.
Right.
What they've done to try to put a Band-Aid, and I did an Instagram post on this recently to give you relevance of when this was recorded, and it was a Band-Aid over a big crack, and it said,
I saw that.
Oh, yeah, saw that one. So essentially, what does it mean to you as a police trainer, as somebody who's passionate about communication, de-escalation, resolving things, less IAs, less physical altercations, less lawsuits, less black eyes, more public trust, a better, more professional police officer, when you see an administration essentially say, we did something, and then they say, what do you do? Well, we gave them some sensitivity training. And what they did was they took the quarterly training in your power DMS and they slid 25 slides in to help you understand the history of the 1700s in America.
Yeah, or they'll put it online, and it's, you know, online training too, that everybody just sits there and clicks and clicks and clicks through. And that's just to meet the mandate. That's just check that box. Okay, we did it. We're good to go now. Now we can, you know, we can go ahead and spend our money on, I don't know, you know, pens and pencils that say, you know, wear your seatbelt or something like that. But really, if you, you know, going back to what you said, Dennis, about the brain surgeon, hospital gives that person training, right? We go into policing, we go to the academy for 6 months or whatever it is. We got a career that goes 20, 25, 30. I know guys who in the state police who did 39 years right? I did 25. Where's your training over that time? You don't think things change, right? Look at how the culture, you know, just since I started in the mid 90s, then the late 90s with the state police, how things have changed. You know, and I went to the academy in 1997, and I was one of those people who tried to get more training. You know, I went to the FBI hostage negotiator school. I went to, you know, all different kinds of stuff. I went to interview schools. I went to, you know, you name it. If I could go to it, I went to it. And the people that do that, it's great, but you really got to push for it. And every one you get, what happens? How many do you get declined for, right? You just got to keep pushing. And unfortunately, sometimes people are told no, and then they're just like, yeah, I'm not even going to bother asking anymore. So I don't know what the change is with administrations to get them to realize this, if they haven't realized it already, with the changes that we've seen in policing just in the last 5 years, let alone the last 20, 25. And every generation, you know, think about when you were new too, right? When people say, oh, kid, it's not like it was, you know, when I came on. So I think that's a generational thing, but it really does mean something because it's not the same as it was back in the 90s. And when I came on in the 90s, it wasn't like it was in the 70s. So on and so forth. And when people come on now, it's not like it was in the 90s. And that'll just keep going down the field. Hopefully administration will come around and start realizing, you know, we have to invest in our people. You know, everybody wants to invest in technology and update the, you know, our computerized reporting systems all the time. Look, you know, how much this stuff does that cost? When really you can send people to classes where you're going to get a return on that investment, like you said, because your use of force is going to go down, your liability is going to go down, the legitimacy of your agency is going to improve, your relationship with the public is just going to improve. When they see you, that this agency is going ahead and starting to talk to people, or even like you talked about before, the agency in New Jersey that just had the officer involved shooting, and the fact that they can talk about for everything they did for 5 or 6 hours, whatever the amount of time was, to prevent that from happening, to try to prevent that from happening. But at the end of the day, the outcome is really heavily based on that individual's actions. That individual took those actions and the officers had no choice but to react the way they did. You know, the more that we can articulate of what we tried to do to communicate with that person before we resorted to that use of force that was necessary, that was objectively reasonable, that we can articulate, don't you think that's going to be so much better? Like you said, avoid that black eye in the community. It's to me, it seems like common sense, right?
There is a thing that I haven't talked about in a while, but I harp on, and just because I come up with new ideas and I don't have new agendas, just new things come to fruition and I don't have to repeat the same thing thousands upon thousands of times. You know, it's funny, today there was a comment on my Instagram and I put out a slide deck that said 5 things you need to know about making traffic stops. And tomorrow, new one's coming out. I wrote these on the plane flying back from Cincinnati earlier in the week. And some dude wrote in there, oh, I'm shocked I'm not hearing about the passenger side approach again. And I wrote back and recommented and said, sorry, bro. My bad for caring so much about you and not dying in the line of duty. And one guy actually wrote back, I'm glad he says it so much because it changed my tactic on traffic stops and it saved my life.
Yeah.
So I harp on these things nonstop because I'm so passionate on the belief of, we are going to increase the likelihood of you not dying in the line of duty.
Yeah.
I know that for a fact. You can argue all you want, but I have proof that it works.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one that I talk about that I haven't talked about in a while. And if you go back to the podcast and hundreds of episodes ago, I've discussed this stuff. There's a really cool way to ensure that you're providing good service to people when you show up as a professional, expected professional law enforcement officer. And that is when you stop a car, when you interact with human beings, when you work with your partners, imagine them being your family. How would you want another police officer to talk to your mother, talk to your father, your brother, your sister, your wife, your husband, your kids? How would you want your kids being treated, your mom, your dad, by the police officer that encountered them, albeit good or bad? How would you expect them to behave towards your people? And if they acted improperly or misbehaved or treated them like shit, how fucking pissed off would you be? How angry would you be if your people were disrespected? And it doesn't matter the fact of your social class, anything like that. Respect is one of the key principles to employing good police work. And you have to have a good discipline of how to do that. So one of those easy ways to do it is like, all right, this lady called. It's a bullshit call, but my mother does stuff like this. So how would I want the cop talking to my mother, right? I love my mother, right? Yeah, we get it. Listen, ma'am, I know that the leaves blow from her property to this property. I get it, right? And this kind of goes back to a little bit more of my theory of what are we responding to as law enforcement? And I think it's a real time in history to start discussing things that can be reported online. And we should not be dispatching resources to stupid shit. And people will say, well, what if you go to stupid shit and you see the body? That I understand. Probability versus possibility. I would take the probability of taking a police officer and leaving him or her available to respond to a real emergency, like a overturned motor vehicle or an active shooter, or leaving them to be proactive, trying to intercept and stop human trafficking, versus going to deal with Dolores, who's pissed off about her fucking neighbor's parking job because she's got nothing better to do with her life. I would say, and we've got to have that spine to say to Dolores, ma'am, we get it. You're going to have to go online. We're not coming out there. We are not here as, albeit public servants, we're not customer service representatives at Zappos. This is not the kind of, we have to, and I would tell people, they'd say, oh, you guys took forever to get here. I'm like, that's cool. I was just giving CPR to a four-year-old.
Yeah.
Just so you know. And you guys are a bumper to bumper crash and you're into this. And people look at me, I'm like, that's what I was doing. I wasn't drinking coffee. We weren't having martinis. We weren't goofing off. Every cop right now, the 21 that we have on the road right now, is trying to knock down and answer the service calls on a Friday in this jurisdiction, the busiest jurisdiction in this county. We are doing our very best to get to everybody as fast as possible. And I never forget saying it to somebody. I'm like, yeah. And they're just like, I didn't know that. I'm like, I know you didn't know that, but I want you to know that. I want you to know that we are not sitting around smoking and joking. Does that happen at 3 a.m. at midnights when you got to take a breather after a day like that? And there's 20 minutes left on the shift. Yeah. Yes, it does. We're human beings. We can only be pressed and pushed, and the batteries drain so much before we just go, we got to breathe for a second. You know, until you've worked through Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Irene, you don't know what it's like to be mentally and physically exhausted and drained and not even thinking about how much money you're making. You're just, this is my job. This is what I signed up for. But what do you think about when I say treat people like they're your family?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I talk about. And I use that exactly. My grandmother turned 102 back in December, and she lives in assisted living. She's up and down, running all over the place. We go to dinner with her a lot. Delivers church flyers to everybody in the building. My mother takes her to church every week. You'd never know she's 102, but that's the way I look at it. How do I want her treated? You know, if she were to call the police, I would want her to get the absolute best service, no matter what it is. You know, it goes back to, hey, the good people call the police, but once in their life. We deal with the frequent flyers all the time, but let's give everybody the best service possible. And yeah, I agree with you. You know, eventually we're going to have to tell them sometimes, hey, we can't do anything about the leaves blowing from her yard to your yard. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what to tell you. You're very upset. You know, in those cases, we just need to go ahead and reflect people's emotions and validate their emotions. And a lot of times that's what they're looking for. They're looking to just be heard, looking to the vent. But yeah, I think we should be giving that service to, you know, what I want grandma to get. Absolutely. You know, that's going to help our legitimacy. That's going to carry over. The public's going to see that. And I really think it's going to just, you know, spread from there, right? Other people are going to see you doing good things in your agency. Hopefully they're going to start doing it well and start looking at it. Hey, how do I want to be my family to be treated? That's huge. You know, that should be something that's taught at the academy, I think, right from day one. Think about when you go out there and you deal with the public, you stop that motorist, no matter who this person is, right? We don't have to be their friends. We don't have to like them. I mean, how many times did I give a hug to a child molester or, you know, somebody who's committed a heinous, heinous crime, right? And I wanted to go home, take a shower, burn my suit. But I showed that person empathy. I projected sincerity, got them to think of me as an ally and influence the behavioral change in them. And that's what we're trying to do with de-escalation too, right? Is influence a behavioral change. And just treat everybody like they're your family, right? Remember the movie Roadhouse? What's Patrick Swayze say? Be nice until it's time to not be nice. And then when it's time not to be nice, that's because we can't talk to people anymore because of their actions, not ours. And that's when we have to use that reasonable force that the courts are going to look at and say, yep, Officer A can articulate everything that he or she did. And the use of force was objectively reasonable and prevented somebody else from getting hurt. And that was a form of de-escalation in itself right there.
You know the benefit of the doubt you get when you're known as somebody who's a good communicator? And when somebody comes in to complain once every 7 years on you, and they go to internal affairs and say, this guy was an asshole to me, he was mean, and he hurt me. They're going to go, man, this is the nicest guy we have here. We are already in disbelief at you telling us this story. We're going to look into it because we have to, but this is absurd. Sure. We had a guy we work with, and I never forget somebody coming to complain for him, and I never forget his sergeant saying, just that. There's no way he did that. But this guy's been working here 8 years. He's an older guy, got on a little older in life. He's the nicest fucking human being we have in this building. And you're telling me he was cursing at you? He doesn't even curse in front of us. He's not one of those guys. He's a bro, right? He's down. Like, he's part of the team. He's one of us. He'll be there for a good guy. Real good dude. You know, I'm proud to say that he got promoted. I don't know where he's at his promotional process because I haven't been there in a while. But certainly somebody who deserves chevrons because of his stoicism, his cool, calm, and collected demeanor. This is somebody who everybody's proud to work with. No question about it. Nobody's ever embarrassed. And then you get the guy on the other side of the coin who everybody's embarrassed to work with. The guy who's the loudmouth, the tough guy. When I go to these classes and train, I think of us as always having this opportunity to really make an impact. And this podcast is no better place to do that because, Jeff, a lot of people listen to this podcast who are thinking about going into law enforcement. And I get these messages all the time like, hey, man, you really swayed me into it. Like, I was getting real dissuaded. I always wanted to be a cop, but like, I hear the purpose that you guys speak with. Yeah, it's the truth. You're just hearing the bullshit lies. Don't ever believe the things you see on the news. But when I see these younger looking cops, I say to them sometimes when people try to challenge you and they go, yeah, all the time. People make fun of how the way you look because you look young. They make comments constantly. Mm-hmm. Your natural reaction is to get very defensive because you're a police officer commanding respect. But it's a real superpower to deploy 20 times more kindness in a situation like that and laugh along with it. And then that puts their guard down as well. Is that going to work every single time? No, but 99% of the time it's going to work.
Sure. It's about making that connection, right? Making a connection with that person. You're making that connection through laughing. You're making that connection by, you know, just coming across as a person to that individual, right? We have this authority that we can fall back on, but we don't always need to use it. Right. That's why I'm such a big believer in, you know, first name basis with people. Talk to people on a first name basis. Call them what they want to be called. And leave our ego at the door. You know, and that's a problem for some people. Like you said, you know, recruiting now, how is recruiting? How, you know, the candidates that everybody's getting. And it just makes you wonder what the pool, you know, the candidate pool is going to look like next year. If they continue to not train people, if we continue to see bad things happening. But I don't think we're going to continue to see bad things happening. I think really, if you look at it, the majority of the public out there supports us. The majority of the public loves what we do. They respect it. But who do we deal with? We deal with the worst in society a lot of times, right? So we're going to see that more often. You know, we can't let that jade us, though. We got to remember that there's good people like your mom, my grandmother, you know, my kids, your kids, you know, there's good people out there, you know, and that's the people that we have to continue to let us, you know, give us that drive to go to work every day and do the right thing and treat people like human beings and treat people nicely until they dictate it's time to not be so nice. And we're going to have such a better career when we talk to people and we make those connections. You know, think about how when we deal with an individual, how we interact with that person is going to affect their next interaction with law enforcement, right? So, for example, how many times during your career did you run into somebody who was pissed off at you right away because of the last interaction they had with police? Somebody gave them a ticket for 3 miles an hour over and yelled at them because, you know, they're, who knows, for going 3 miles an hour over the speed limit, they yelled at them, screamed at them. Well, now you're the asshole next time you deal with them when you're going to go up and treat them like a human being. And then it's hard for us to go ahead and step back from that. But we have to because we can't mirror people's emotions. We can't act the same way that they do. So even when they're upset with us, bring that extra cup of kindness with you until it's time not to be, until you're faced with an immediate threat and you've got to take some kind of action to protect yourself. Communication, man. All about communication and connection.
You gave us a tip before and two things. I want you to elaborate on that a little bit more and I'll give you a lead down that road. And I'm also going to cite Chris Voss's book, Never Split the Difference. He's on the podcast next month.
Okay.
Really, really happy to have him coming on. Obviously, all these guests are great. But the first tip you gave is first name basis. Tell us what cops typically do and tell us what really works.
Well, I'll give you an example of when I was a young trooper. Somebody asked me my name once and I said Trooper Scholes. She asked me my first name and I said Trooper. Where'd that get me? Nowhere. Right? So if I just go up to people and say, hey, I'm Jeff. What's going on today? What am I doing? I'm inviting some conversation. I'm not saying I'm trooper. I'm not saying I'm investigator. I'm not saying I'm senior investigator. Leave the authority behind. All right. They already know who you are because of your uniform or the badge on your belt and the gun. All right. Leave that out. Just keep it on a human level. Be sincere. People aren't going to want to talk to somebody who's not sincere. Goes back to the whole thing. How do we make our friendships? How do we make our relationships? Well, we have to communicate with that person first, right? We have to have some type of communication. Really, the only people in our lives that we don't have to have that kind of communication to bring them into our lives, right, is our parents and our children. Everybody else in our life, we've had to have some type of communication to establish that relationship with that person. And it wasn't shitty communication, because if it was, that person wouldn't be our significant other. They wouldn't be our friend. They wouldn't be our associate. They wouldn't want to work with us. They might have to, but they wouldn't want to work with us. But no, we establish relationships through communication, through good communication. So that's why I say, you know, when you're dealing with de-escalation, when you're dealing with a crisis, you're trying to intervene in a crisis, you're trying to bring down somebody's emotions, you're going to use skills that you already have. And I want you to get a new perspective on it. I want you to think about it in a different way. And I want you to think of it as woke policing, right? It's making a connection, you know, and when we make that connection with our friends, our significant others, we're using first names. We're using empathy. We're using compassion. And if we carry that over into our job, we're going to get better successes. We're going to get more consent to search vehicles. We're going to get more confessions. We're going to get more admissions. We're going to get people to acquiesce to what we want to do much, much more easily. Make our job so much easier and safer. And also, you know, you go back to administrations, you know, you got the nicest guy in the department there. That's going to help get promoted too, right? Because if you have these skills to go ahead and de-escalate people verbally and you have less use of force, isn't that going to look better in your jacket than somebody who's got a stack of use of force incidents and personnel complaints, and whether they're founded, unfounded, unsubstantiated, whatever they are? Think about it. The more you have of those, doesn't that sometimes whittle down your chances of getting into that unit that you wanted, getting that promotion that you want? So the benefits of this across the board are just, you know, it helps with professionalism too. It helps you in court too. What's a defense attorney's worst nightmare when it comes to the police? Somebody who's prepared, professional, and articulate.
Before, just to give some clarity, because I can just see that people will try to take anything that we say and twist it. Clearly, if you've never done an interview with the news media, do one with them. You'll give them 900 statements and you'll see they'll report on the fact that you passed gas at minute 13 and they heard it, and that you're a criminal because of that. They're fucking unbelievable. Anyway,
right.
So earlier he talked about getting consent, getting confessions, getting people to work with you. Let's be very clear. We're talking about being able to communicate to people who are involved in criminal activity before, during, or after the commission of a criminal offense. So this is not like we're trying to get everybody to just relinquish their Fourth Amendment rights.
Oh,
we're
God,
trying
to actually help.
Yeah, we're trying to get people who are pretty much guilty of doing something that they should not be doing.
Reasonable suspicion to, that we can articulate a reasonable suspicion about this person. Yeah, absolutely.
Even with probable cause, right? You get a PC to search a house, even with PC. And then we're trying to communicate to them some of their best options to make better decisions on their behalf, and understand that we're not going to. You know how many times I honestly, I don't want to say rewarded, but certainly felt a different way about somebody who got themselves in trouble. And when it was asked to me later on of like, hey, what do you want to do with this? Like, listen, he was a great guy. He fucked up. He made a mistake. It happens. They were kids at the time. He was like 19. You know, it's a year later. The guy clearly cleaned up his act. Whatever you guys want to do. He was never giving me a hard time. And then, you know, we're human beings. You know, the guy got 7 more arrests. He was an asshole the whole time. He was running his mouth. What do you want to do with this? I mean, you know, I don't know if he's learned his lesson yet. You know, if you're asking me what I want to do with this, I want to emphasize that You know, I have concerns about this gentleman returning back to society. This is not somebody who's rehabbed themselves. So, you know, we're trying to help people get to their, and I got to tell you, I don't know if there's anything more rewarding in police work than being able to communicate with people. No bullshit. Before, during, or after the whole incident or the encounter with them. I mean, you know how many bromances that I had in the booking area after I locked people up?
Sure. Because you treated them well, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you treated them well.
I'm inclined to do everything I can for you, right? I'm inclined to even go beyond. Listen, I'm always going to do what I have to do. But for those people, I'm inclined to go above and beyond.
It's huge, man. That's rapport building, right? You're going to change. You're going to influence somebody to change their behavior. Yeah, we're never looking to coerce somebody. You know, when I talk about it, it's going to get you confessions. It's going to get you admissions. It's going to get you consents. It's only going to get you that because you're treating them like a human being. They're thinking of you as an ally. You're not using any kind of trickery. You're not lying. You're not doing anything illegal, unethical, or immoral. No, you're making a connection with that person as a human being. You're projecting sincerity. You're using empathy, compassion. You're treating them like a human being. It's going to get you better results because it's all part of that communication. It's all part of that connection. You know, people want to be listened to. They want to be heard and they want to be treated like a human being, even if they haven't treated other people like human beings, right? Good stuff.
Some of the best cops I ever met in my life, including myself, had a pack of Newports in the fucking bag.
Absolutely. Right. Always had a pack of cigarettes in my patrol bag as a trooper. Pack of cigarettes in my desk as an investigator. Absolutely.
And dude, it's literally, I would never even say, I want to know some stuff. Will you trade me a cigarette?
No.
Jeff, we'd get out of the car in the Sallyport. I would close the door. It was against policy, probably, but half the fucking police department was smoking in the Sallyport anyway when it was cold out.
Right.
And I say, dude, sometimes this is no bullshit. I wouldn't even have anything that I was trying to extract. I would just go, yo, you want a cigarette before you go in? I know you smoke. And they're like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah, I got cigarettes, bro. Let me hit you up with one. And bro, it's like the third pull. And it's like, yo, did you guys?
Everything comes down, yeah.
Yeah, like, did you guys know that there was, like, did you have a robbery that happened at 7-Eleven? Like, a couple months ago on the one on fucking that street? Yeah, I remember that shit. I know the guy that did that. Mm-hmm. Right? Then I'm calling the Decta Bureau. What do you got? Hey, got a lead on that 7-Eleven armed robbery, boys. How the fuck did you figure that out? Cost me 20 cents.
Yep.
And you got guys who are so binary, so black and white. They're like, I would never do that. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Fucking RoboCops.
Dude, it's, and they just don't understand that this is not the military. You got to get that through your head. I know you went to an academy where they thought you were in the military. You enjoyed that military.
Yes, sir.
Bearing.
Right. Yeah.
This ain't the fucking military, man. As a matter of fact, I think we could revamp the police academies in a sense of creating that high stress environment, but like without the drill instruction. You know, I understand why. And I think it could be like the participation. And if you don't participate, you're out, right? Like, what are we doing today? You're going to run the fucking beach here, right? We're going to run 3 miles. Your ass better keep up. And if you can't, you're just out. You don't do this job anymore. So, and don't give up, right? But I also don't think that, you know, man, I don't know. There's just so many stupid things we're doing because of tradition. And then we're setting these people out after these academies with nothing. And then these motherfuckers got the balls to go to these fucking academy graduations and say, we're the finest training institution in the state, right? Like, at least if you're going to say that and declare that, have something to show for it, because I've talked to half your class before they graduated. They've said this is a joke and they know nothing, but they know how to march, right? Yep. We got to stop telling ourselves this story that this is what it's supposed to be, because we are paying for it on the back end tremendously. And people are paying for it. Society's paying for it.
They sure are. And they got to look at that long-term investment, because like I said before, how long does a career last? 20, 25, 30, 35, close to 40 years sometimes. Right. So agencies, administrations, politicians, they got to look ahead too. They got to look ahead and prepare these people, not just to get out onto the street after 6 months, but what are they going to do to help them get through the rest of their career? What kind of in-service training are they going to get? Let's stop checking the boxes. You know, what kind of mental health services are they going to get? Right. Because that's a big thing now too. And that's a big part of de-escalation, I think, is when you start doing de-escalation with people, when you start doing crisis negotiation, things like that, you're dealing with people who have got some real bad shit going on, right? So, you know, we can take that home too. And that's one of the things I talk about briefly at the end of my class is, you know, let's think about our mental health and things that we can do to make sure that that's okay. Because when I started, there was nothing for it. Nobody cared, right? It was just, you know, one bad thing to the next, one body to the next, one car accident to the next, you know, one abused kid to the next. Nobody cared. Now we're starting to look at that. I think, you know, in a sense, we're starting to be better about that. But I think more agencies, more academies need to put more of that in right away. And, you know, really think about not just the end of that 6 months, but what that officer is going to get down for, you know, typically, which what is probably a third of their life. Long time.
Oh, you mean sitting in a room and signing, sitting in a room and signing that you acknowledge policies for 5 days when you have no idea what they say is not good training for police.
Right.
That remembers that day, right? Your first week at the police academy.
Signing everything. You're even signing that they can videotape you and
That too. You know? 5 days of being in a closet with your 3-4 other guys that you got hired with, or 10 or 12 or whatever it may be, signing policies, just like literally like you're a president of a company signing executive orders just to ensure that they later on can show that you signed the policy, you said you understood it, acknowledge it, and every person in the world in this profession has never read any of them.
Right, yeah.
And policies
you could sign your mortgage away, right? Your first day there, they're just going to put paper in front of you and you could sign your mortgage away. You'd never know the difference.
The people don't realize is when you're coming to this profession, and it takes a little while to figure this out, SOPs and policy are put in place to do one thing, and that's punish you in case they want to. It's just their ammo in the tank, and you'll learn it the first time you have an internal and they serve you with like 11 charges because you wore the different color shirts. Different color shorts or a different color undershirt or socks, or your mustache went beyond your corner of your lip. Like, I'm telling you, and they're not meant to be strictly followed. They're actually, if you follow military history and people who are military advocates, it's meant to be used as a guideline to help you make a decision, not completely in accordance with policy.
Right.
Crazy. But listen, Jeff, I got to say this. I'm so thankful that you chose us to be with. I'm so proud that you're part of this company. I think you're going to have great things for the world. And I think all of us at the end of the day are happy and proud of the work that we do, knowing that we're not pandering to society. We come on this podcast, we explain ourselves and what we're doing, showing everybody, the world, that we have the real life solutions and giving some practical advice that men and women in law enforcement can take out and use in the field. And also people who are listening to this who are non-law enforcement can say, I have a much better understanding of what you guys are going through because you communicated this to me on this platform. So I just want to say thank you, dude.
No, thank you too, man. So happy to be a part of the company and happy to talk about this all the time. And I know they're finishing up my on-demand class now too. Jay and her crew have done an awesome job doing edits for me. You got the best people working there and you're really doing great things. I'm really happy and proud to be a part of it. So thank you too.
Thanks, brother. This is a great episode, by the way. It's a really good one.
All right. Thanks, man.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.